big around.
Oh.
You have too big.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. We're going to start off. We have four bills today. We're going to start off with the Employment Department Office of Administrative Hearings Bills 2439. And with that, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2439.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure requires the party who is requesting a hearing to be reopened with the Office of Administrative Hearings to provide a copy of the request to the Employment Department. And it allows the Employment Department to dismiss a request for a hearing with the Office of Administrative Hearings under specified circumstances. It's declaring an emergency effective on passage. And you have a paper copy before you, a proposed Dash 1 amendment that came from the department. And it specifies if the department dismisses a hearing request, the party may request a hearing on that dismissal.
Thank you. David Gerstenfield. Feld. For all these years, I still mess up your name.
Good morning, Chair Holvey. Thank you, members of the committee. David Gerstenfeld, although I'm used to Gerstenfield as well. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department, here testifying in favor of House Bill 2439. And this bill makes some what we think are pretty minor procedural changes to hearing requests involving unemployment insurance benefits. So when my staff make decisions about unemployment insurance benefits, if either a worker or a business disagrees with the decision, they can request a hearing. Those hearings are then held by an independent administrative law judge from the Office of Administrative Hearings. Right now, in the statute, there are a list of seven criteria that allow an administrative law judge to dismiss the hearing request. And basically, those are when there's not really a live dispute anymore between the Employment Department and the parties. What 2439 seeks to do is not to change any of those criteria, but to let the Employment Department issue the dismissal in four of those specific circumstances. And those are when either the person that requested a hearing withdraws the request, if the decision that was appealed is either canceled or amended so that the issue isn't there to be disputed anymore, if someone requests a hearing before the decision is actually issued, or if the person that requested the hearing doesn't have legal standing to challenge the decision. So in those circumstances, there's not really a live dispute to be heard between the parties. Right now, in those circumstances, the Employment Department has to send those cases to the Office of Administrative Hearings so that an administrative law judge can issue the dismissal. This bill would just permit the Employment Department to issue the dismissal itself. It was mentioned that there is a Dash 1 amendment, and that just makes it clear that if someone challenges the Employment Department's dismissal for some reason, thinks that we should not have dismissed the hearing, in that case, there really is still a live dispute, and in those situations, we would just send it over to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and an independent administrative law judge would hear the matter and make a decision. So in conclusion, we support the bill. It doesn't impact who has the right to request a hearing, who will be able to have a hearing. It really just changes when there's not any longer dispute who it is that will be issuing the dismissal. And this authority is similar to the authority that other agencies have under the Attorney General's Model Rules of Procedure. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone have questions about this bill?
That's a smile on my face.
Just for the record, I have asked the Office of Administrative Hearings Oversight Committee to look at this bill and let us know what they think about it. I'm not expecting any problems with it, but anyway, I'm hoping that they'll get a chance to weigh in on this soon. And one other question, David. I know you had talked to my staff about an additional amendment, and since I wasn't here yesterday, I didn't quite catch the outcome of that conversation.
Chair Holby, no additional amendment is necessary. So the Dash 1 amendment that's there, we think, addresses everything, and we did work with both the Office of Administrative Hearings and the Employment Appeals Board on the language for that amendment.
Great. Thank you for engaging the different parties on this. I appreciate it. So no questions. I guess I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on this exciting bill.
was tough.
Up next, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2440. Jan, would you give us a brief description?
I will, Mr. Chair, committee members. This measure requires a reduction of unemployment insurance benefits to the claimant who is receiving back pay for a time period during which benefits were received. And it allows the claimant to be eligible for those benefits when they are outside of their local labor market for purposes of applying for a job within their local labor market. Declares an emergency effective on passage, and there are no amendments.
Thank you. We'll have David Gerstenfeld. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Chair Hobley, members of the committee, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department, here testifying in support of House Bill 2440, which makes changes regarding unemployment insurance eligibility. It addresses two situations, one dealing with people who leave their local labor market or their local area for a period of time, and the other deals with people receiving back pay. For the local area issue, right now when someone is out of their local area for most of a week, they do not receive unemployment benefits unless they're looking for work in the place that they're visiting. Not too often, but periodically we have people who leave their local labor market area because they're required to do so to look for a job that they're going to perform back home. So for instance, someone in the Salem area that's applying for a job in Salem that's required to go to an interview in Washington, D.C. before they officially get the job. Right now under the statute, they're not eligible for benefits for the week that they leave their Salem to go to Washington, D.C. to apply for the job. So the change that House Bill 2440 makes is simply that if you're required to leave your local area in order to apply for a job, that does not make you ineligible for benefits for that week. The other change that it makes has to do with back pay. Unemployment insurance benefits are an important safety net there for people who become unemployed, and the intent is that when you're unemployed, it provides partial replacement of the wages that you aren't receiving because you have no job. There was a 1990 court case that dealt with a situation where someone received unemployment benefits and then after the fact received an award of back pay. And that arose out of someone who received benefits, claimed that they were wrongfully discharged and prevailed, and then received back pay for the same time period that they received benefits. And the court case said that under the way our statutes are structured, the person is entitled to retain both the full wages that they've received for that time period and also the unemployment benefits that were intended to be a partial replacement for the wages that they didn't originally get. This issue doesn't come up too often. It came up fairly publicly towards the end of 2013 when the federal government shut down, and there were some furloughed employees as a result. So during that time, they received benefits. After the fact, the federal government retroactively gave them their back pay, their full pay for the time period they'd also received the unemployment benefits. State law in Oregon is pretty clear that they're able to retain both. We did get contacted by the Department of Labor as one of about three states nationally where that's how the law works. Most other states treats those back pay as earnings. And there was a significant amount of interest from the media and from some legislators about this situation. In the federal government shutdown, there were some wrinkles because it was federal benefit payments being made to federal employees, so they did end up being overpayments. But in a similar situation in Oregon, if there's a private sector furlough or a state-level furlough, or if it is someone who gets discharged and then receives back pay awarded through a settlement or court award, right now the law allows the person to retain both the full wages and the unemployment insurance benefits for the same time period. So the other change that House Bill 2440 makes is that it would count those back wages as earnings. The impact of that would be to make the unemployment benefits they had received an overpayment. Because the overpayment isn't caused by anything that the worker did, in those circumstances, the only way that the law provides for us to recover those overpayments is by offsetting them against future unemployment benefits they would otherwise receive. So for a period of 5 years, if they would receive some unemployment benefits, if they had an overpayment of $500, the first $500 would instead repay their prior overpayment. There is a waiver provision in the law that says if that offsetting would create a financial hardship for the person, that we can waive that offsetting until it would not present a hardship to the individual. So those are the two changes that House Bill 2440 makes, and the Employment Department is obviously supporting those.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Doherty.
Okay. I have a couple of questions on this. And so the whole thing is I'm out on unemployment, and through some, maybe a class action, whatever, I get some back wages for the time that I was out on unemployment.
Okay. Correct.
Now, what happens if 4.5 years down the road, and this is going to be credited against my my unemployment account, I guess. Is that what you mean?
Chair Holby, Representative Doherty, that's essentially correct. We would say that it was an overpayment. So using $500 as an example, we would just say the first $500 of future benefits that you would otherwise receive, we will instead go to repay this overpayment.
Because I know you said that there'd be a hardship thing, you go through and investigate. And the question is okay, I'm laid off 4.5 years later, and obviously the $500, that I got as overpayment is gone. It's, spent a long time ago. How long do I have to wait before you guys tell me whether I have a hardship case? So am I going to go like maybe 5 weeks without any money?
We resolve the hardship things relatively quickly. When we're getting the overpayment requests, overpayment issues or the hardship requests, we're generally able to resolve all of those within a month. Our standard in terms of making an initial payment when you restart an unemployment claim is to make the first payment within 21 days. So it may extend that in some circumstances, but not by a significant amount, at least with our current workloads.
Okay, follow-up question?
Follow-up.
Okay, and so the $500 that I got in back pay or whatever, does unemployment insurance come out of that? Because it sounds like the money that was given to me, unemployment is taken off, yet you're crediting something against my account.
Chair Holby, Representative Doherty, there's no unemployment portion taken out of the employee's part of their wages. Mm-hmm. So if the employee gives you a back pay, if the employer gives you a back pay award of $500 or $1,000 or whatever it was, they will pay a payroll tax on the additional wages that you get. But that's part of the employer's obligation. It's not something that is deducted out of your gross back pay.
Okay, and final follow-up.
Please.
And so can the employer come after you and say, look, I already paid unemployment benefits or taxes, yet you're not giving the person unemployment benefits?
Chair Holby, Representative Doherty, no, because in that case, if we recover the overpayment, then their tax account wouldn't be impacted. Until we recover the overpayment from you, their tax account would still be impacted. So they would be able to challenge whether you're eligible or not. But really, the tax is a separate obligation. The employer pays the payroll tax regardless of whether any employees ever receive unemployment benefits. Their tax rate may change if they have more employees that receive benefits. But it is a general payroll tax, kind of like an insurance premium. Whether someone collects on it or not, the premium, in this case, the payroll tax, is still paid.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm wondering, how stringent are the hardship requirements? I can hardly imagine anyone not filing a hardship claim.
Chair Holby, Representative Kinnemer, what we did, we originally had some of our own standards, and that was very cumbersome for us to administer. Mm-hmm. And we looked, and the Internal Revenue Service had actually much more detailed standards, so we adopted those. Those look at family size and down to county level where the person resides, and has some standards for how much it costs for housing, for food, for kind of everyday expenses. We do also, we added an exception at the state level where if someone has some extraordinary circumstances, for instance, maybe they have a lot of medical bills that have to be paid, we can take that into account. But our general default is to use the IRS guidelines for defining a financial hardship.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up, mm-hmm. if I could. So do you have a ballpark about how often it's granted?
Mm-hmm. Chair Holby, Representative Kinnemer, I don't have that data here. I can certainly follow up and get that to you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Fagan.
Just as a practical matter, I'm just curious how this would work. And Representative Doherty used an example of maybe a lawsuit that's settled. how would you even get notice of that? I mean, particularly since, you know, probably upwards of 90%+ of civil lawsuits regarding employment settle and don't go to a full trial. And then often they're confidential settlements. So just on a practical level, how do you guys get access to, you know, an amount that may be deemed as back pay?
Chair Hovey, Representative Fagan, right now we don't, because right now it doesn't impact their unemployment eligibility. Going forward, what we would likely do is to ask people when they claim if they've received back pay for that time period. We're not going to be scouring court records, both because of a resource issue and also, as you pointed out, that would only capture a small percentage. So we would be asking people if they do continue to claim benefits in the future. Right now, we ask people a series of questions each week about if you received any pay, did you receive vacation pay, did you work, and some other eligibility questions. So this is likely another question that we would ask people. Or if we get information, if the employer were to notify us, you know, if we get information through another source, we would follow up.
Representative Noss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is the only way to collect the back payment against future benefits, would anybody ever just cut you a check and say, I got overpaid, here's the $500 I owe you, and not sort of charge against their account?
Chair Holby, Representative Noss, they can cut a check and send it to us. During the federal government shutdown, we did have some employees do that. It's relatively rare, and if they do that, it's voluntary. By statute, the only way that we're permitted to pursue recovering this type of overpayment where the person who was overpaid didn't cause it is to offset against future benefits.
Follow-up.
It's not a follow-up, but it's more of a statement. It's just that I'm sympathetic to what the Employment Department is saying, right? It's an overpayment, right? But I'm guessing, you know, then the next time someone's unemployed 4 or 5 years down the road and they immediately start $500 in the hole, I mean, you know, I'm guessing for a lot of people that'd be a hardship.
So generally unemployment insurance benefits are, I guess, a portion of what a individual's total salary would be. Is there an average for what that percentage would be?
Chair Hovey, I can get that. I think in Oregon the formula overall works out to about 2/3, but I can confirm that.
2/3 of your salary is what your unemployment benefit is?
Right. And what we do is we take a snapshot of your prior earnings, but that's about the target of what it's designed to replace.
So you also mentioned that you were contacted by the U.S. Department of Labor on this, and I'm just curious, did they proactively contact the state of Oregon and say that you're out of conformity with their rules?
Chair Holby, they did proactively contact us. They did not say that this was a federal conformity issue, that they would essentially say Oregon's unemployment program doesn't count for federal purposes. They did express concerns about the public perception and support of the unemployment insurance program, and among the few states, Oregon and a couple of others, where people were permitted to retain both the benefits and their back wages. So it's not a federal conformity issues, but they shared pretty frankly their concerns about permitting people to keep the benefits when they had also received the back wages ultimately.
Seems unusual they would be worried about perceptions, but having said that,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
I guess something that might help. How often does this happen?
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, it does not happen that often. It's hard to give exact numbers. As I mentioned in response to Representative Fagan's question, we don't track it. From our experience, the federal government shutdown certainly raised the profile of this as an issue for us to look at. I would say normally we become aware of situations like this maybe a handful of times a year.
So I'm curious if somebody doesn't have any future benefits 5 years later, does this go on into perpetuity, or do you forget it at some point?
Chair Holby, after 5 years, it's erased off the books. And if a person files a new claim 5 years and a day afterwards, then there would be no offsetting, and they'd be entitled to all of their unemployment benefits.
Interesting. So there's no consideration either of, you know, the perhaps economic impact of somebody having to wait several years to get back pay to that individual. So it's just a dollar for dollar adjustment.
Chair Holby, it's actually not a dollar for dollar adjustment. What we do is we then treat the back pay the same as if it had been earnings at the time they received it. Realistically, if someone gets their full paycheck, then likely they're not going to be eligible for any unemployment benefits. If it was someone who maybe had a couple of part-time jobs and this was just one of their jobs, then we would do what we do if they had earned that money at the time. And there's a formula where it's not dollar for dollar. The idea is that once you hit a certain threshold, it's about a 3-for-1 for every the idea is to make sure that you're getting your minimum amount. So it's not dollar for dollar. We look at, I think it's 10 times the minimum wage or more than your regular benefit amount. And if your earnings are more than that, then we start to reduce your benefits.
Interesting policy decision. I don't see any other questions. Appreciate you explaining this to us. Up next, Graham Traynor.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Graham Traynor, here representing the Oregon AFL-CIO, the statewide federation of labor unions. And the Oregon AFL-CIO, as many of you know, consistently plays a defensive role in critical worker protections in the state. And I wanted to raise for the committee some concerns about the subject that was actually just being talked about, the repayment of benefits issue. We have no concerns about the other section that was talked about, Section 2, I believe, in the bill. But in Section 1, we try to think about these types of issues in terms of what a low-wage worker would face in the economy. And from our perspective, again, many of these issues just got sort of raised a second ago. But from our perspective, if a low-wage worker wins a wrongful termination case after, you know, down the road, and that in the future sets them back with their ability to really rely on a critical worker protection, we have a concern with that, and it's. From our perspective, our job to sort of raise these types of issues, federal conformity issues are one thing, but when a policy decision gets made by an agency around something that, from our perspective, is a benefit takeaway from current practice, we have concerns. And again, we appreciate the Employment Department's above conversations up to this point, and they've been very forthright in sort of exploring the impacts of this to a worker, but I felt like it was important to at least get these on the record, these concerns that again, many of the committee members have come to their own conclusions on. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Questions?
I didn't read anything or hear anything about specifically just low-wage workers. Where are you getting that from?
Chair Holby, Representative Hurd, when we analyze an issue around the safety net and critical worker protections, we often think about the most vulnerable worker in the economy. Of course, this affects any worker that would apply or that would claim an unemployment benefit. But from our perspective, it would be most impactful and most a hardship for the lowest wage workers in the economy to face down the road a challenge to receiving a claim that they're really relying on. Take a minimum wage worker, for example. So that's where that came from, Representative Hurd.
Follow up. But you would admit it's double payment for the same time worked, correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, there's no questioning the examples that have been laid out. I think that one of the one of the things that we've thought a lot about and talked about as we've analyzed this policy is that it's not the workers' fault that they have this overlap, right? It's an inadvertent overlap, and they're paid back down the road that they may not be expecting at the time that they claim the benefit. But that overlap is inadvertent. It's not the workers' fault, and we know how we work when we have a check in our pocket. We cash it, and it's not the worker, especially a low-wage worker, who's really depending on that benefit's responsibility to be, saving up for what could be a challenge they face in the future when they go to claim a benefit.
Not their responsibility to save?
Follow-up,
sorry. It's not their responsibility to
say. Rep Holvey, Chair Holvey, Rep Hurd, I appreciate the question. Of course, it's anyone's responsibility, and I apologize for the comment and what that led to in a reaction. I do feel like, we just feel like, this economy is disproportionately impacting low wage workers, especially minimum wage workers, and it's really important to think about through the lens that they would face these challenges in the future when policy decisions like this get made.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sitting here thinking about it, and I'm very sympathetic to where you're at, but it's one of those things I'm wondering if it's when they receive those back pay, if there should be a note with it that a portion of this should be going to cover your unemployment benefits, or you may have a reduction of unemployment benefits if we should. The letter shouldn't be going out to the person who received that back pay over that time. So that will, let's just say the government shut down and everything. Everybody went out and signed up for unemployment. And these aren't low-wage workers, I'm sure, at the federal level with the checks that were coming in. But once that they received the check from the federal government or the employer, at that point, would it make sense for them to say, if you were receiving unemployment benefits, you should be make sure you pay those or you may not receive the unemployment benefits next time? Or maybe it's something we just include when people sign up for unemployment, because you're receiving money that should be just turned around and transferred to somebody else because you're taking payment when you're also trying to get payment over here. So you're double dipping, and they're knowingly double dipping when they do that. So they should know that they're liable to give some of that money back because they were receiving the unemployment business, so they were double-dipping on the employer at that point. So the biggest thing is, how do you get that person who received the benefits to return them to the state of Oregon or to the unemployment department? Have you thought about that at all?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, thanks for the question. I don't know that we've thought about that sort of down the road, what if the policy is implemented scenario. I do believe that we're talking about some scenarios, clearly, where there's a knowingly a double dip happening. But I also think there's, I would imagine, and again, the Employment Department talked about the rare cases that this is even an issue. But when it is an issue, especially for a lower wage worker, I'm guessing that there's no knowledge of the double dipping being the case. And I think it would be up to the department to figure out the way to transition into a policy if they, if this were to become a practice of the department. But and I'm sure there's a lot of things that you just raised that could be part of that solution.
Representative Hurd.
So if I may, a suggestion. Because I agree with you, an individual who is earning at the minimum wage level or slightly above, it's going to be a major impact for them to mm-hmm. have to wait for their benefits to catch up with this problem. Mm-hmm. So what about a 24 or 36 month payback plan? So say it's $500, however that would divide up over 36 months, that simply just gets paid back through a deduction from their paycheck, just in small $5 or $10 increments, so that it's evened out by the time it's likely that they may have another employment claim to make.
Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, I think that at the end of the day, while there could be creative solutions explored if this becomes the policy of the department, at the end of the day, our concern is still really with that burden that, again, the most vulnerable worker would face in the future. And again, you know, what the creative solutions a department might choose to pursue down the road would be in their hands. But from our perspective and a worker advocate perspective, it's still a hardship down the road and in many cases would be an inadvertent overlap of repayment that they would be on the hook for down the road.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just a general comment, you know, in light of the fact that typically unemployment benefits are about two-thirds of the normal wage, it's quite a bonus. And it does give me some pause. I'm not sure how to solve it. And I appreciate the department coming forward with this because I think it's a bit of a teaser, and it's hard to know. I mean, none of us would want to give back a bonus. On the other hand, it has implications for the rates everybody else pays, and has implications for personal responsibility. And
yeah,
enough said.
Thank you, Representative Nose.
To that, I would just say I think it's incumbent for us to remember that except in one pretty high-profile situation that happened recently, right?
Yep.
Otherwise, this does not happen very often, right? I mean, it's pretty rare that this occurs.
Right. And maybe we'll get the department to give us the actual number of cases where this has happened annually over the last couple of years and what the dollar impact has been on the trust fund for that specific situation. I'm sure you don't have that off the top of your head.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So,
Chair.
Representative Widener, one more question.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a for question, comment for the day. Let's see, what bills do we have next? I don't care about banking anymore. To me, I mean, 5 years and the slate's wiped clean, that seems pretty reasonable. So what the department's done to me seems pretty straightforward and reasonable for everybody across the board. I mean, I've been fortunate. I haven't had to go sign up to receive unemployment benefits, but I've always kind of been on my own or moving from one job to another. But I know the importance of it because I did log when I was going to school and worked in the woods. And you would have times where it would rain or you would be out for a couple weeks or 3 weeks at a time. So I know the importance of having those benefits. But to get the slate wiped clean after 5 years and I think is reasonable. I think what they brought forward is reasonable. If you want to talk with the department and come up with something more reasonable, you know, I guess that's your prerogative and then we have to decide on it. But I think we need to do what's fair for everybody across the board, and I think the department did a very good job here. So. I don't think I've ever said
thank you,
a state agency like that.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. With that, I'd close the public hearing on House Bill 2440.
Take your medication.
And open a hearing on House Bill 2415.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this bill requires financial institutions or credit unions to disclose the deceased customer's account balance. I'm going to address the proposed -2 amendments instead because it replaces the original measure, and that is what the sponsors are requesting. So just looking at the -2 amendments, which I believe you have right before you, it allows the Department of Human Services or the Oregon Health Authority to request financial institutions to release specified information regarding the deposit accounts that are held by deceased persons. It creates exception to the prohibited release of private financial records. That is it.
Thank you. Rick Mills. Welcome to the committee this morning, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holby. Good morning. My name is Rick Mills. I'm a policy analyst with the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery, Oregon Department of Human Services. I'm here to speak in support of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2415. Under current law, when certain individuals that receive public assistance or medical assistance pass away, we are required to seek reimbursement for all of the benefits that they received from their estate. One of the tools that we use to recover those funds is a statutory authority that allows us to go to financial institutions where that individual had accounts and request that financial institution to disperse those funds directly to us. We currently estimate that we recover about $2 to $3 million a year using that that statutory authority, but we think we can do better. And so we reached out to the Oregon Bankers Association and the Northwest Credit Union Association through their respective legal counsels and asked for their help to try to come up with some solutions as to how we can improve our recoveries under these circumstances. Happily, both organizations were very responsive and very helpful, and the Dash 2 amendment is the product of that collaboration. Both organizations support that Dash 2 amendment. Basically, in real simple terms, what that Dash 2 amendment will do is it will allow us to obtain from financial institutions information which in the past has historically been unavailable to us or would require a very difficult and expensive process to obtain. That information, which we would now be able to get from the financial institutions, we believe would allow us to locate funds that we would otherwise miss in the estate recovery process, and also would allow us to do a better cost-benefit analysis before we incurred a lot of unnecessary expenses, only to find out that maybe there was $20 there. So we would encourage you to adopt the Dash 2 amendments, which are supported by us and the two organizations, and send this to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. I, of course, am happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Doherty.
Okay. The one question I have when I went through and read the bill, and until you said it was people who were getting services and benefits from DHS,
yes.
I read the bill as just saying it was anybody.
No.
And so is it clear in the legislative language that these are people that are receiving benefits from DHS or OHA or whatever? Because when I read the whole thing and I went, so if I died, they would have to go through and do this. And so I just want to make sure that it's in the language, making it clear of who the people are that
Chair Holby, Representative Doherty, I think if you were to look on line 14 okay. on the first page of the Dash 2 amendment, says the state that the deceased individual received public assistance okay. or medical assistance that was subject to a claim for reimbursement under, and there it cites the four statutes which we use to engage.
Because I was looking at the other one and it didn't say
yeah,
that, so.
I can understand the
Thank
confusion.
You very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions? We'll note you're the first one that has asked us to pass a bill with a due pass recommendation to the floor of this session. I'm sure you it won't be the last.
I don't have a whole lot of bills, but I'm not too shy. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Anyone else wanted to testify on this bill? Went rather easy.
See, the credit union folks and the bankers are here, and they're nodding their heads in agreement. So
with yeah. that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2415. And left on the agenda, the bill we've all been waiting for. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2350.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure updates and clarifies portions of the Bank Act and related statutes, becomes operative January 1, 2016, declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments before you today. And I want to note that the committee received a letter of support from the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute that's available on OLIS.
And were they supporting the proposed amendment?
No amendments before you.
Thank you. Kevin Christensen and Ken Sherman. And David Tatman. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, Kevin Christensen. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Bankers Association. Thanks for hearing this bill. We're pleased to be before you, and we'd like to probably be the second group to ask for a do-pass recommendation to send in the bill to the floor. I'll just put that on the record. With me is our General Counsel, Ken Sherman, of Sherman, John and Hoyt. He is our General Counsel and has been so since, I think, mid to late 70s. So all things banking, we generally turn to Ken for his guidance with respect to that. By way of background, the Oregon Bankers Association is the full-service trade association representing Oregon state and federally chartered banks and trust companies. Our banks are FDIC-insured institutions, and we have right now 28, I believe, banks headquartered here in Oregon, and 25 of those are Oregon state chartered banks. There's some consolidation going on, so those numbers will change probably in the next couple of months, if I'm not mistaken, but that's where I believe we're at right now. I'll speak just very briefly and then turn it over to Ken here just in terms of background. Before you is HB 2350, which is our bank modernization bill. And what it does is essentially modernizes the Bank Act, which is found in ORS 706 through 716. This is essentially the bank controlling law for the administration of banks here in the state of Oregon and primarily focused with our smaller state chartered banks in particular. By way of further background, for those of you who are on the committee, in 2013 we had a similar bill, albeit much shorter, 2070, which also did some changes to the Bank Act, and that was really an opportunity for us. There were a few issues that were raised by our members. For instance, things like the number of board meetings that were necessary for a bank, audit reports going to DCBS, the frequency and how those go in. So real kind of mechanical things that some of our members wanted to have changed. You passed that bill. Following the passage of 2070, our members asked us to kind of get under the hood and see where we were at with respect to the Bank Act, because it hadn't been modernized since 1997, I believe, was the last time in which there was a full-scale really analysis, and there have been a lot of changes in the industry. And so we did just that, is open it up in conjunction with not only bankers who had some suggestions, but also bank attorneys, auditors, and we also work very closely with DCBS with respect to this, because we wanted as much as possible to get a consensus bill on issues that we were all on the same pages with. And so through a series of meetings, calls, a lot of emails back and forth, we've been working with, like I said, those folks, including staff at DCBS, which I'd just like to say thank you very much, because it's been a very good process with respect to that interaction, trying to get this this bill correct. So with that, I will turn it over to Ken with one note. We are in the midst, I think we're about 95% to 98% of the way there. There are a few technical tweaks that we're trying to finalize right now. We met with DCBS representative last Thursday, and I think we're pretty close to getting that submitted. But like I said, I think this is a good bill. We would ask your support and a do-pass recommendation, send it to the floor. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ken and answer any questions the committee has.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman. I'm an attorney here in private practice here in Salem, and I've represented the Oregon Bankers Association since 1977. My recollection is that the Bank Act, which is chapters 706 through 716, was substantially rewritten in about 1974, just before I came on board. And then we went through another such exercise. It was quite thorough in 1997, and I got to be a part of that process. Here we are again, 18 years later, again, just modernizing our code. And as Kevin has said, this is not a bill that contains significant new powers or it changes the structure of banking or anything like this. It's really much more technical in its focus and designed to modernize the rules in those chapters under which banks in Oregon operate. Kevin has given, I think, a pretty good overview, and I thought I could just spend a minute. We passed out copies of some written testimony, and I assume you have that or will have that in front of you. And it lists, I don't know, half a dozen or a dozen and a half or so specific areas of change. I don't want to just read through those, but let me highlight two or three just to give you kind of a flavor of this bill. First of all, there are extensive definitions at the front end of the Bank Act. They're in ORS Chapter 706, Sections 005 and 008. Those definitions, some of them have, time has moved on and it's necessary to update them. We found that one of the interesting things about the Bank Act, there's about 35 ways in Oregon to say bank. There are federal savings banks and federal stock savings banks, and we've just got lots of little titles. And as we look through the act as a kind of a holistic thing, we found that some of those are used not at all, and some are used very infrequently. And so we've tried to simplify the structure of the act by taking out those definitions and doing some combinations of definitions to make the code more approachable. Another thing that we've done is throughout the Act, and particularly in Chapter 708A, which is the chapter that kind of lays out the general operating rules for banks, there was some nomenclature. Some of those 35 names that we use for banks were misapplied in several places, and so we went through and said, well, the use of this term doesn't really fit the substance of this statute, so we made those adjustments as necessary. Another kind of change that we made was to, there are a number of cross-references in the Bank Act to federal statutes and regulations, and because of the constitutional prohibition against this legislature delegating authority to other bodies of government, those all relate to a specific date and time, which is, I think, essentially 1997 in most, if not all, cases in the current law. We needed to update that because, of course, the federal law doesn't stand still either, and there are new regulations, so we updated those cross-references. Another kind of a change that we incorporated into this bill is to recognize that the culture of financial affairs is changing. One of the things that we've been concerned about is how access occurs to people's financial assets. And so we added, for instance, a specific statute that would allow a bank, give bank express authority to refuse to pay a check if it suspects that the customer of the bank is a victim of financial exploitation. That was something that the division thought was important, and we agreed. We've always been very active in the association in trying to guard against that kind of abuse of our customers' interests, and so we were happy to add that provision. Those are just a few of the kinds of things we're dealing with, and as Kevin mentioned, I guess with any piece of legislation as long and technical as this, you're going to have a few places where things kind of fall off the table in the drafting process. So I'm currently working on a set of amendments that we will bring back to you shortly. I'm almost done with them. And then we'll present those to you. But again, they're going to be on the same technical level. So with that, I'll stop, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? So, since I had nothing to do yesterday, I was looking in the bill for a definition of a POD. Couldn't quite find it anywhere. What is that?
A POD is a type of account. It's one of several what we call multiple party accounts, where you have more than one person who's on the account. And a POD account is a payable on death account. And it's actually defined in 708A. I think it's 455. It's specifically an account that I can set up with myself as the owner, the initial owner of the account, and then I can name one or more people to whom the funds in the account will be paid upon my death. So it's just one of the one species of a joint account that is specifically provided for in the Bank Act.
Okay. I'm impressed with your answer.
I was impressed.
Knew the statute on the top of your head.
Well, they promised me that if we get this right this time, they may let me retire one of these days. So.
But normally, it must be defined someplace in this bill, I would assume, but I could not find it. So.
Chair, hopefully, members of the committee, we're not interested in letting him retire for that reason.
my other somewhat, I won't call it a real serious question, but is to the department. So, Mr. Tapman, I guess you need to introduce yourself for the record after I ask you this question. But going through this bill, you know, I'm seeing all this updates, and I'm thinking to myself, where does the department get the money to do all the things that are asked of it in this bill? Yeah, how are you going to keep, you know, your up and coming staff employed to do all this work? Because I don't really see a lot of charges or fees in this bill, so they must come from someplace else in the statute.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, by way of introduction, my name is David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We're the agency within the Department of Consumer and Business Services charged with regulation of banks, credit unions, and other financial institutions. 2 points. First, thank you for not asking me the first question. I couldn't have answered it in that same capable fashion. Although the answer is sometimes when things are amended, certain sections aren't addressed, and so that's maybe why you didn't see it in the bill. Second of all, I have to say this was a request by the Oregon Bankers Association, something that we appreciated being brought in from the earliest stages to have the conversation around, but it was around modernization. It was not around financial issues. Frankly, I just had my banking program manager take a look at the fees that are charged by the state of Oregon vis-a-vis the fees charged in other Western states. And for the most part, we're significantly lower. And it's something that I know the Oregon Bankers Association recognizes and appreciates. Frankly, just to get a little bit ahead of ourselves, we will be having a task force this spring to look at that very issue of how we finance the whole program and what the right level of regulation is. So it's a timely question. And it frankly, if we had brought this later, we might be asking for a review of the fees. But the fees are where they are right now, and we just felt like it wasn't appropriate to try and mix the two together. So in terms of how we finance our program, it's done through an assessment of all the banks. It's a calculation to try and determine approximately what we expend in terms of manpower or person hours per bank, plus the administration of the Bank Act itself. We have a very industrious program manager who puts in an inordinate amount of time, far and above what he gets compensated for. So that's really how we get a lot of this done. The changes that the Oregon Bankers Association and through the assistance of our agency is proposing are mostly technical changes. We don't think that's going to increase our workload significantly. What's changed significantly over the past 10, 15, 20 years is we've had several federal law changes that have really lowered the barrier of entry for banking. And so we see a lot of changes there. A lot of them are not state chartered. We do require that they file certain things. As Mr. Sherman mentioned, some of the amendments that we're proposing will address things like that. We want to be kept on notification by non-state chartered banks when things take place in Oregon. For instance, if a branch is closed, we want to be notified. We want to know who's doing business in the state, and for that, to the contrary position, who's not doing business in the state when they choose to leave. So most of this is technical. The amendments we've asked, we've got about 10 amendments we're asking for, and they're all of a very similar technical nature for the most part. So we don't think this will increase our burden significantly. We think these are all things that are important and timely because of the changes. As you know, Dodd-Frank and the recent crisis that the economy went through has changed the financial services industry significantly, and some of these changes are reflected in that. And so the state, as you know, doesn't normally weigh in on a position other than we say the process was very successful. They're very receptive to what we had to say. We thought it was a good working group, and we think the product reflects all the input that was provided or will when the amendments come down.
Thank you. Appreciate the question, and I appreciate the answer. And I'm sure we'll The bankers will work with you to figure out what the appropriate level of fees would be, to because it's important that you're able to accomplish what they ask you to do in a timely manner, I'm sure. So with that, I don't have anything else. Any other questions? Thank you. We'll look forward to seeing the amendments as soon as we can.
Thank
and
you.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2350. Pretty light schedule today.
Oh, there's a work session to move the tax credit bill.
Correct. Open a work session on House Bill 2116.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this bill extends the sunset to 2022 for the tax credits for expenses for household independent care services necessary for gainful employment. There are no amendments before you, and I'll just remind you that we had Chris Alanoff before the committee last week to talk about tax credits in general and the four that are related to child and dependent care.
Mr. Chair, this is a non-debatable motion to suspend the rules. So do we want to discuss it beforehand and explain what we're doing? It sounds perhaps scarier than it is.
Yes, I think, thank you, Vice Chair. I think we can do that without a motion first. You know, committee, as you recall, we talked about with Chris Alanuck the process of reviewing tax credits before they go as a policy matter, before they go back. And it came to light that this particular tax credit that was referred to this committee was a companion tax credit with another one on child care, and it got mixed up with the employer one, and the two tax credits dealing with child care really should be considered side by side so they could make a decision. So I requested that we get a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing to send this to them where appropriately they can review both of those tax credits. So that's all we're doing. We're not going to make a recommendation on whether this should be passed. It'll be without recommendation. So, Representative Widener.
I think one other thing to note for some of the new members and stuff too, Mr. Chair, is even after Human Services, it'll probably still have to go to Revenue to even get approved. So this started here, and it's got to go through two more committees before it ever gets a chance to go anywhere.
Yes, but to be more accurate, it goes to the Committee on
Tax Credits.
Joint Committee on Tax Credits, and not to Revenue.
You ready for a motion, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Chair Holvey, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 2116 without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time.
Vice Chair Barton moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 2116 without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time. The motion is undebatable. Those of the opinion that the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 2116 without having the fiscal impact revenue impact statements on hand would say aye.
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 And there is there any objection? There is no objection. The motion carries and the rules have been suspended.
I assume you need to follow up now to actually move it. That's cool. Mm-hmm. Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2116 to the floor without recommendation and that a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing be added.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2116 to the floor without recommendation that a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing be added. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion passes. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2116. And any other business? I'm Kinnamer.
Mr. Chair, just thank you for a very business-like meeting.
There was a little labor in it as well. So with that, I will close the House Committee on Business and Labor. Committee on Business and Labor.